We have removed the Pelt Trout Hatchery Partnership item, as it shows on the agenda. We talked about that yesterday. So we'll move into item 14, Wolf Plan Implementation and Follow-Up.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Dave Ware. I'm the game division manager for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And this morning, we're going to talk about the Wolf Plan and kind of give you an update on where we've been. So what we're going to cover today is I'm going to give you a quick overview of the entire process of what we've done since the plan was adopted in December. And then and we'll get into some of the details on some of the events, some of the things that have happened in the past a few weeks associated with managing wolves. And so some of the kinds of things that we're going to touch on in more detail is the staff that we've hired, and give you a little bit of a biography on some of them, where they're stationed. I'll give you an update on the captures. I think we covered some of that already, but we'll do a little more of that. We'll talk about some of the preventative measures that we've used to date and kind of where we're going with that, or where we're trying to go with that. We'll give you some detail on the depredation event that occurred in Okanagan County. And then we'll talk a little bit about the Northeast Washington livestock team and some of the processes that we put in place to date to deal with depredations. So kind of the quick overview on accomplishments to date. So when we started to put together how we were going to implement the Wolf Plan, at the director's encouragement, we put together a broad group within the agency that kind of guides everything that we're doing. And so we looked at there's 12 objectives in the Wolf Plan, 12 major objectives. And so we took the top six, at least in our view, the top six priorities of the Wolf Plan, and then started to lay out a schedule for how we would get those done and which ones we would do first and that kind of thing. And some of them that we'll go through are pretty obvious to folks in terms of their relative priority. But we didn't leave out any of the objectives. We're also developing a long-term project plan for how we would accomplish all of the objectives within the plan. And so the six that we took on first were, of course, monitoring wolf population and status, protecting wolves from mortality, managing wolf-livestock conflicts, developing an outreach program, coordination with various agencies, landowners, and NGOs, and then a reporting schedule, which has been fairly frequent for you so far in terms of how we would get information out. So what we've done, again, to date on monitoring wolf populations, we went to the legislature and asked for funding to help us get started. We were successful in that endeavor. We received an appropriation of about $350,000 for our wolf management work for the 2012-13 fiscal years. We also received an additional $50,000 in authorization for payment of livestock losses. Since then we've developed a web-based reporting tool, an associated toll-free number for the public, one front door, so they know how to contact the agency with wolf information, both sightings as well as suspected depredations. We integrated maps that had been provided by the public that had already been working on sightings and location information, and incorporated that into our web database. And we're receiving five or six calls a week now with reports on wolf sightings. And I'll get to how we're using that information here in a minute. To date, we've documented five packs, and we have five more suspected packs, and that's kind of laying the groundwork for our capture plans for this summer. We've hired two biologists to capture and monitor wolves full-time with assistance from the district bios, our carnivore specialists, and other field staff. In addition, we hired two technicians to follow up on reported sightings and prepare for capture efforts. We also have recently hired a contractor to help us do that, and we have a LEA grant with Conservation Northwest to do some of that work as well on all carnivores, but including wolves. The new information, I think you heard about this already, is we've captured a couple of adult males from the Smackout pack late this past week. We're in the process of creating a total of three capture crews with associated equipment and logistics to support capture operations. Next objective was how do we protect wolves from mortality. And so part of that is just the monitoring activities and outfitting wolves with radio collars. That's a big part of protecting them from mortality. In addition, we went to the legislature with a carnivore bill that almost made its way through the entire legislature that would have classified wolves as a game animal and would have increased the fines for illegally killing a wolf. We will go back, or we're planning at least at this point to go back and pursue that again this next session. And then we've also made wolf incident reports a priority for all field staff, and touch on that a little bit some more later. But with the level of priority that the director has given this, it's been fairly easy to do everything from buy a truck to get folks to understand that it is a priority and they need to respond and report quickly. So managing wolf-livestock conflicts, so the legislature authorized, again, $50,000 from the wildlife account so that we would use the ORCA, which is the endangered species account, the ORCA background plate, for wolf depredations, and then the non-restricted account would be used for any cougar or bear losses. We developed a claims process for livestock that are lost to carnivores. Conducted an agency training workshop on depredation investigation, developed an incident response manual, developed an incident response report form, and a protocol for determining the cause of livestock death involving other agencies. We drafted a conflict escalation matrix for agency actions depending on the relative risk or actual livestock depredations when the use of lethal tools might be employed. And again, we've developed one contact point for all suspected wolf depredations. To date, we've responded to at least three wolf incident reports and offered landowners assistance with preventative measures. One didn't need the assistance because the wolf didn't return. One did accept the use of a range rider, cooperatively funded between Conservation Northwest and the department. One has accepted flattery in his calving pen and was issued the first caught in the act lethal permit if wolves had penetrated the flattery. We've responded to the wolf depredation on a calf, and our newly developed process played out fairly well. We are following up with the landowner to determine if he would accept our assistance with keeping wolves away. We've also ordered quite a few materials, flattery, rag boxes, screamer devices, etc., to assist landowners, and we've borrowed those to date that we've got in the field right now, but our own materials will be arriving soon. We're drafting WACs regulation changes for the August Commission meeting, so you'll see those coming pretty quick so that we can make livestock compensation more consistent with the Wolf Plan. The issues are mainly associated with using the Federal and Defenders of Wildlife funds for losses other than horses, cattle, and sheep, and for non-commercial livestock operators. We conducted several meetings, but we're planning several more meetings with livestock operators to update them with wolf information and to address their needs for compensation of losses. And I'll touch on the most recent one in Northeast Washington. We've also developed an outreach program, or the beginnings of one. So we have products to date include talking points that we provided to agency staff so they know how to refer people that have incidents or information requests so they all know where to go. We developed a small group of stakeholders to review actions by the agency, and we've been sending them copies of everything that we've been doing for their review and comment. To date, they have reviewed and supported the claims process, the issuance of the Caught in the Act permit, and they're currently reviewing the what we're calling the incident or the conflict escalation matrix. And they will, of course, be involved in reviewing the WACs and various informational items. We're in close communication with the affected tribes, especially the Colville tribe, who have a suspected pack on their reservation, and the Spokanes are beginning to suspect that they have a pack forming as well on their reservation. We've communicated frequently with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on their status review that's ongoing. And as I mentioned, we've been participating in terms of outreach and with the workshops with the Northeast Livestock Operators, and we've prepared an article for the Cattlemen's newsletter, which is called Catch Pen. That's coming out probably Monday, and so there's an article in there, again, encouraging landowners to contact us and providing them with the information how they can do that. Touched a little bit on preventative measures as well. We've been meeting with the U.S. Forest Service grazing permit holders so that those permit holders understand if they've got wolves in the area, and again, some of the things that we can do to help them if they're interested. We've developed a brochure for use in rural communities to encourage reporting of wolf observations and incidents, as well as an overview, again, of the preventative measures. We'll be doing a television piece with Gary Chittum on trapping wolves, and so that'll be aired on one of the West Side stations. I can't remember which station he works with. We used the... What's that?
You might not want that in the record that you don't know.
I'll back that out. We used the depredation incident in the Methow. Again, this is the outreach objective to put out a news release, again, encouraging people to contact us on suspected depredations quickly. And you remember that Nate's message in the hunting pamphlet also talks a little bit about our focus on wolves and the fact that we are paying attention and trying to make sure we understand what's going on if there are impacts from wolves. And so most of our outreach today has been focused on livestock and rural communities. We will be moving as we get closer to the hunting season. We will be moving more into outreach information for hunters as well. We've kind of identified a series of audiences that we want to reach and develop materials for those different audiences. In terms of reporting, you've been receiving regular updates at the commission meetings, of course, and we've been meeting fairly regularly with livestock organizations and updating the hunting community mainly through our Game Management Advisory Council. We continue to put out news releases for milestones, and then we will develop an annual report, and we're looking to expand that quite a bit from what we've seen in the past or what we've produced in the past. Part of that is for use with our report to the Fish and Wildlife Service. As I mentioned, we're also laying out a long-term plan to make sure we get all of these so we can identify a schedule or sequence of tasks and schedule activities to make sure that we don't miss a beat and that we're anticipating what's going on in terms of recovery so that we can effectively and efficiently start the downlisting process or try to address things before they happen. With that, first I'd like to introduce our new staff. I think you heard a report last month that we were in that process. We've hired two wildlife biologists who will focus on, they're not here today, but that who will focus on the capture operations and monitoring. One is Paul Frame. He's been with us for a few years now. He'll be stationed in Spokane. He reports to Dr. Martorello here in Olympia, and he's leading the one of the trapping crews with, again, primary responsibility for trapping and monitoring. He's just finishing up work now in the smackout pack. Scott Becker is also a wildlife biologist, too. He's stationed in Wenatchee, again, reporting to Dr. Martorello. He's just finalizing his trapping equipment inventory and will be in trapping activities in the lookout pack beginning next week. He has, again, the primary responsibility for the second crew. In addition, we've hired Tiffany Baker. She's a scientific technician stationed in Colville and reporting to the local wildlife biologist there, Jay Shepard. And she's mainly following up on some of the detection information that we've been receiving through our reporting system, as well as other reports. And then Gabriel Spence, Gabe Spence, he's also a scientific technician. He's stationed in Wenatchee, and he reports to the local biologist, Dave Volson. Like Tiffany, Gabe will be working on detection of packs. And so, of course, the idea is there is that We use information that we've gathered from the webpage and other sources. We go out and set cameras and or gather additional information on where we see wolf activity, and if it's significant enough, we follow up with a capture operation.
Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think I didn't catch the third capture crew. Paul's been with us from last year, and we've got a new guy that's going to start pretty soon.
Yes.
Where's the third one?
I was going to get to that. That's actually the third crew is going to start down in the Blue Mountains, and it's made up of a technician that's been with us for several years, Ben Maletsky, and he's partnering with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Hillary Cooley, and so that makes up our third team.
And Cooley is the trapper?
She's the one that's got the most experience with wolf trapping, yes.
Has she ever trapped wolves?
Yes.
Where?
All over, but right now she's stationed in Boise, Idaho.
And she starts next week?
No, those will be on by about the end of the month.
Director Anderson?
Could you also, I understand we've got a personal service contract?
Yes. I mentioned that briefly earlier. We have a personal services contract with Jeff Flood. He's a fellow that's been doing a lot of work already in terms of detections, and so we're looking to put him on contract to help us, again, find locations of wolf activity so that we can follow up on those.
And he starts?
He'll start next week. We're getting him a truck, I think, Monday or Tuesday.
Commissioner Duvia, follow?
I was just going to ask if Flood, is he going to be used for locating?
Yes.
Only, or does he work with Paul, or?
He'll be working with the whole crew. Dr. Martorell is the one that set up the contract, and so I'm guessing he's the lead and probably be one of the main contacts for Jeff, but also wherever he's working, wherever he's assigned gather locations. He'll be working with the local district biologists as well.
So, Colville or Spokane, or
he'll be mostly that whole northeast area is my guess where we'll end up deploying him quite a bit. He's currently on contract, I think, with my understanding at least with the Colvilles, and he's assisting with the capture efforts on the Colville Reservation as well. So,
yeah, his boss is
Donnie.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dave, just for my own information, what is the rate of restitution for livestock depredation by wolves?
It's a graduated scale, and it's it depends on which source of funds we use. The legislature has capped the livestock compensation at $1,500 for cattle and for horses, and $200 for sheep. It's up to those amounts, and so it's actual value of the animal up to that amount. The wolf plan calls for similar in terms of compensating for actual losses, but the way that the schedule is laid out on the wolf plan, if we can confirm that was a wolf caused depredation, then we'll actually pay twice or pay for two animals rather than one. And so that's...
If I may, is it the same for a calf as a mature animal?
No, they have to... The landowner, when he's filling out the claims forms, would have to demonstrate how they arrived at the value of the animal. And, of course, we would cross-reference that with... current livestock prices that are produced, and we're going to be working with other entities, Farm Bureau and Cattlemen's Association, to make sure that we've got the right prices.
Thank you.
I want to find out. You're not done with your...
Oh no.
Yeah.
So when we started our capture operations this year, we set out a schedule, and one of the things that we did instantly, we wanted to be pretty adaptive and be able to move wherever we think that we need to in terms of being adaptable. And so earlier this year, in April, there was quite a bit of activity in the Wedge. We had a property owner there that had some concerns about wolves in and around its cattle, and so we actually started there. We spent a couple of weeks without success there, but again, pretty much driven by need. And so the rest of the schedule for this summer, what I've got on the screen is the five known packs in light blue, and those are, and they're odd shaped polygons. Those are because we've actually had radios on those packs, and so we've got information on their home range, or at least they're in the state of Washington. The darker circles are suspected packs to date, and so that is kind of how we laid out our summer trapping schedule, was based on these. We started in the Wedge. We quickly went to the Hosamine. That's a wolf pack that appears to. We've got enough information that we're pretty sure that there's a pack that's using Washington, but it seems like they mainly use us during the wintertime for wintering, and then they move back into British Columbia during the summer. So by the time we got in there, they were already gone. So we spent a few days looking for them, and then Paul moved to the Smack Out pack, and we'll touch more on that a little bit later. But and then, as I mentioned, Scott Becker's working the lookout pack, and again the third crew will be starting down in the Blue Mountains.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. A little curious. The trappers we've finally got in the field this spring are on the Smack Out pack and on the lookout pack. We had them for a little while on the Wedge, but pulled out. But why are we? When we're trying to figure out how many packs we got and getting this many collars at each pack, why are we collaring more people on more wolves on the existing packs we already know about and not trying to collar the unknown packs that are suspect?
I'll show you a little more about that in a second, why we do that. Our objective, our plan, is to work each of these suspected packs for about 2 weeks at a time and try to get two collars on different members of the pack. And I'll show you an example here in a second of why that's important for us.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Dave, pertinent to the Wedge pack, I understand that's been made complicated by the presence of a grizzly, apparently with a couple cubs. What has that changed your trapping plan, and how are you going to compensate with this new information?
Really what it's changed is our trapping technique. And we've been working with the Fish and Wildlife Service on what we can do. And if we have a known presence of a grizzly bear, we need to pull our traps, and that's what we'll be doing. But if we don't have recent information about grizzly bear presence, then we would use, instead of using a drag-based trap, we would use a fixed-based trap. That allows a bear to pull out of the trap fairly easily. Okay. And that's one of the reasons that we've delayed a week getting into the lookout pack, is because that's still part of the North Cascades grizzly bear recovery zone, and so when we're in there, we need to be using the anchored traps rather than the pull-out traps. We also attach a transmitter to each of the traps so that we can monitor what's going on with them.
In terms of just keeping everybody up to date on what's going on, I know Carter Niemeyer is with the Kaval tribes as we speak, and they have one or two packs on the Kaval reservation that they're brought him in to trap. I noticed that's not one of the suspected packs, nor the Spokane tribes have got a pack or two that's been on the reservation and is outside the reservation. It's not on our map either. Are we...
Most of that is insensitivity to the tribes and displaying information on our reservation on our public handouts and things, but we are working with them, and especially I think the Colvilles will be pretty amenable to us as soon as they capture one, counting that as a...
I think they're pretty open and working with us, so I'm surprised to hear that they don't want us. They don't want us to put a...
No, we haven't. I don't think we've necessarily asked them the question. We've just been sensitive to the sovereign issue, sovereignty issue. But we could certainly update, ask them, and update our maps based on those discussions. So here's a couple of slides of the wolves that we caught on the Smackout Pack. This is the first adult male that was captured, and here's the second adult male was captured. We're not sure yet which one is the alpha male. Suspect that either one of these could be. This one actually weighed a little more, but might be a little younger than the previous one. And so. Again, Paul's moving to the wedge next, and I think he's in the process of doing that. Now we'll take a little segue, and here's the rationale for having more than one wolf with a radio collar on it. I think you probably also heard about this, but so initially we weren't thinking we were going to need to trap in the Tiano area because we had two collars on wolves and within that pack, and so that wasn't part of our summer schedule. Well, one of those collared wolves decided to go for a walkabout, and this one is 015. You've probably heard about OR7 that did a walkabout from Oregon down into California. Well, this one did a walkabout up into British Columbia, and has recently met with demise. Got into a livestock. I think it was a hog facility, but anyway, got into trouble up there and was killed. But you can see, I mean, this tells you a lot about how much these animals move, and you know, in terms of dispersal, but also lends credence to why we try to get collars on more than one animal. This was a 2-year-old female that again just dispersing from that pack and moved a long ways north and past an existing pack.
Commissioner Jennings.
But we still have at least one collared individual in the Tanaway?
Yes, so actually trapping efforts there shouldn't be very difficult, and I think that's probably where we'll go once we're done with the lookout pack, or once Scott's done with the lookout pack.
Commissioner Perry, did you?
Yeah, I was going to wait to the end, okay. Yeah, why don't you just continue, Dave? I'll wait.
So in terms of preventative measures, I've talked quite a bit about that already, but you know, a lot of the most common, most effective tools have to do with the use of fladry or turbo fladry, range riders, rag boxes, some pyrotechnics, but those have been the most successful in the past, and those are the ones, the kinds of equipment that we're trying to purchase at this point, and the techniques that we're trying to use. The turbo fladry, or fladry, is typically just those flags that you can see in this photo that are spread about every 18 inches on wire. And in this case, this slide, it shows that this sheep operation brings their sheep in the evening into a smaller area, protects them with the fladry, and then continues to opens that back up when they're ready to move the sheep to other parts of the range. We used that this year on a calving operation near the wedge, and it appeared to work fairly successfully based on the tracks that we saw and how wolves appeared to stay away from that once we got the electrified fladry up especially. In addition, range riders is a common technique that has been used in areas with wolves fairly effectively. It can be relatively expensive in terms of a cattle operation, but human presence and you know, just basically checking on the livestock fairly regularly seems to help, as well as especially in the Smackout Pack, with the now that we've got a couple of wolves collared, That information of where the locations of those of that wolf pack can be relayed to the livestock operator and to the range rider, and so they'll know when they need to be more vigilant and try to keep the wolves and prevent the wolves from getting into the cattle. So those are probably two of the more common techniques, and we're gearing up to be able to assist landowners with those.
Let me ask a question about the phylactery. So you bring the sheep in at night, and that seems to suggest that this is most effective if wolves are confining their hunting to nighttime. But when the sheep are out during the day, they're vulnerable. And so what do we know about when wolves hunt and how adaptable they are to opportunity?
Well, wolves are certainly adaptable, but in most cases, what they've seen is that it's the nighttime when sheep and calves are most susceptible to being depredated on, and so again, that's why that's done. I think it's more of a common practice with sheep herders to bring the sheep in together at night anyway, but anyway, and so that's just been proven to be more effective. At least on wolves, not so much on other predators for sheep.
Okay.
So now I'm going to walk you through the depredation event, and the main purpose for this is just to demonstrate what the process is that we use to investigate a depredation event and make a determination, and then what we do as a result of that. And so here's the part where I'm going to tell you that if you're squeamish, you should look away when we get into some of these later slides. We've tried to keep it fairly mild, though. So on May 21st, the department received a call. The local officer received a call from the landowner near Carlton, which is close to our lookout pack. Officer Tresser responded immediately. However, when he got there, the carcass was already consumed. As it turned out, the event had occurred 2 days earlier, and the landowner was just not comfortable contacting the agency at that point. The landowner, Mr. Thurlow, when the officer arrived, described two coyotes that he had seen running away from the scene. When he got to the site, the calf was so severely injured that he actually euthanized the calf. He did take a few photos, which turned out to be very helpful, and that calf was about 200 pounds, which is of interest because it's kind of the threshold for what we encourage turnout. We encourage livestock operators to wait until after they hit about 200 pounds before they turn them out. That's mostly on open range. So as a result of that preliminary investigation, Officer Tressler contacted the local biologist, Scott Fitkin. They both returned that evening to complete an investigation. They did find several 4 to 5 inch canid tracks, which is consistent with wolves. However, the carcass was pretty much consumed. Again, it was 2 days later. They did necropsy, or basically review the carcass, and they found puncture wounds that in the hide that were consistent with wolf. The photos of the calf the day of the incident also revealed injuries that are consistent with depredation by wolves. It was in close proximity to the lookout pack. Mr. Thurlow's description of the canids leaving the site were actually consistent with the size differences and appearances of recent photos of the lookout pack. So as a result of that information that was collected, we put together a group that included the Fish and Wildlife Service and USDA's Wildlife Services staff. They all received the incident report. They received copies of the photos from the incident, and we held a conference call and made the determination that the incident was classified as a probable wolf depredation. So with the classification of a probable wolf depredation, the landowner is eligible for compensation. And we provided those forms to Mr. Thurlow. He is completing them and plans to submit them. We also identified that as a priority for trapping and radio collaring, and again, that starts on Monday. We're also coordinating with the Fish and Wildlife Service and Mr. Thurlow on ways to prevent additional depredations. At this point, they're pretty hesitant to allow staff onto their property, but we continue to pursue an agreement with them. So here's the home range of the lookout pack, and you can see that the incident actually occurred right here within a couple of miles of the town of Carlton. This is a photo of the site. You can see it's pretty open, and you can get an idea of the operation in terms of the age of the calves. They were about 3.5 months old, and again, about 200 pounds. Here's the actual site of the depredation. Was right around this tree. And here's one of the photos that that Mr. Thurlow had taken of the calf that was turned out to be very helpful in terms of making a determination. And of course, that's what it looked like by the time we got there. A couple of days later, it had been scavenged fairly significantly.
So could you back up to the previous slide? And just sort of point out some of the things that made it look like a probable wolf.
The things that were consistent with the wolf depredation had to do with where the injuries occurred. In addition, it's not as obvious from this slide, but the tail was pretty deformed in terms of the wolf attack. In addition, you see trauma here and trauma here again. Consistent with how wolves would have progressed in the attack. Here's a recent photo. This was taken last winter, obviously, of the two animals that are known to remain from the lookout pack, and you can see the size differential, which was consistent with the livestock operator's description.
Chair, why would we pause a question?
Yes, Commissioner Schmidt.
Dave, is there a difference between probable and confirmed? Is there
from the landowner's perspective, the biggest difference is just the level of compensation that he might receive. But even if it was a confirmed depredation, we would still ask enough questions about, are you missing additional calves, and in terms of making him eligible for additional payment. But probable allows him to get paid for the animal that was lost.
Director Anderson.
What additional information would you have needed in order to have it classified as a confirmed as opposed to probable?
If we can get there quick enough, you can actually, first of all, one of the other things that occurred, and I've got a copy of the incident report if anybody's interested in looking at it themselves, but one of the issues when you get there quickly is that you see what other tracks are in the area. Well, ultimately, because this was a couple of days later, there were coyote tracks in the area as well. Hard to say what all scavenged on that dead calf. So there were other tracks in the area that might not have been there if we'd been able to get to it quickly. When we do the necropsy, we would be looking for bruising. Because obviously if a wolf comes in and feeds on something that's already dead that was killed by something else, a lot of the evidence that you're going to find is just consistent with scavenging or consuming an animal rather than did it actually cause the death. And so hemorrhaging is also a part of that. The bite marks are fresher in terms of measuring and some of those kinds of things as well, rather than from a dried hide.
Commissioner Perry?
That was my question as well.
So moving on, I guess we covered most of that. If we can get radios on that pack, I think that's going to help us a lot in addressing Mr. Thurlow's issues. In addition,
Commissioner Caney wants to say.
Sorry, Dave. That's okay. I didn't realize you were moving on. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. I just wanted to say that I did talk with some of the WDFW staff about this, and I wanted to really commend them for the efforts they put in and the. They just did a great job. I mean, it can be a tough situation, and I think they just went above and beyond, you know. And Anyway, I wanted to say that, and that I think they did an outstanding job of documenting, of responding to the Thurlows. I also want to ask you, as you move forward from here, it gets more serious, I guess, because those wolves were the base information, I think, that was put out by the Department of Wildlife is please contact us immediately, which is very important, not just for compensation, but because if those wolves are allowed to feed, and apparently they did, they've now got it in their memory that this works. So they would tend to want to come back. And as they come back, you know, a second depredation could be the next step towards taking those animals out. So there's this whole process that becomes very important. And I think the next process for those landowners is to do a very good job of avoiding another incident. And I'm just curious, if they're not very willing to cooperate, where do you go with that? I mean, if they have another depredation, you'd want to know that they did some attempts at keeping that from happening. And can you speak to that just a little?
I'll get into that here in a second. That's a good segue into the discussions that we had with the Northeast Washington livestock operators as well. I think in general, a lot of frustration from the livestock community at this point that the department's encouraging them to change, in some cases, the way that they're managing their operation. And it's like, we've been doing this for a long time and just fine, and because of the management actions of the agency and allowing wolves to recolonize the state, now we've got all these impacts on our operation. And so in some cases, and I think Mr. Thurlow may fall into this situation as well, it's at least initially there's some hesitancy for them to change what they're doing. I think if you read some of the local information in the local newspaper, they did talk about some of the things that we've been encouraging them to do, and at least at this point they're a little bit hesitant to do any of those things, but I think they might. You're exactly right in terms of habituating, if you will, wolves on livestock, and so sanitation is probably the number one thing that a livestock operator could do, but again, it increases their costs. And in this case, I think Mr. Thurlow probably could have dealt with removing the carcass right away, and it probably could have helped. In other cases, and this was the case for most of the folks that we talked to in the Northeast Washington Livestock Operators team, they're mostly ranging, their operations are mostly cow-calf operations on open range. And so they don't have that opportunity because they're not in contact with those animals to even know when a depredation might occur, and so a little more difficult for them. But anyway, so I think, and you're right, multiple depredations and or multiple incidents does raise the level of the bar in terms of lethal removal activities on those packs. In this particular case, because they're in the western two-thirds of Washington under the federal endangered listing. Lethal removal probably is not an option, at least at this point. And so that's why we're working as hard as we are and being as persistent as we are, trying to convince the Thurlows to let us help. But also in addition, with only two known packs within that range, removing and or using lethal options in a recovery area with only two known packs is not going to be very, we're not going to want to do that very, very much.
Thank you.
And I'll get at that a little bit in the Northeast group because it might be a little different there. And I do think we need to be prepared for that.
Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think that point you made, Dave, is want to just reemphasize that. In Northeast Washington, they're willing to do any defensive mechanisms we want. But like the boneyard for them is nowhere close to where their cows are grazing. So they'll do it, but it's not going to be of any value in terms of keeping the wolves off, or very rarely will it be. Releasing stock at 200 pounds is three times more expensive than losing animals. So most of those things they've looked at and would do, but they're financially, it would not be a good decision for them. So the problem we have is a lot of the defensive things probably would help, but they're so expensive, they're not
appropriate business decision for these guys to make.
And I think that is what we're going to have to pay attention to as we move forward. We've got several staff members that are pretty familiar with the techniques that are used for or the most effective techniques that are used. But I think in terms of outreach, one of the things that we're thinking about is that maybe we needed to work a little closer with the livestock community, and they'll help us figure out what's feasible and what's not, and where they might need some financial assistance. And especially, and I keep trying to reiterate this with folks, is that especially during the early phases of where we're at right now with recolonization in most of Washington, we can be pretty helpful, and we want to be helpful in terms of helping folks finance the use of some of these measures. And so I'll talk a little bit about the Northeast Washington group. And so one of the techniques that's used in a lot of the other states, and something that we talked about in our Wolf Plan as well, has to do with using local groups to help address what the major issues are for them. In some of the states like Oregon and Wyoming, they actually have a local board that makes the decisions on whether a livestock operator gets compensated or not, how much they get compensated, providing in the case of Oregon and Wyoming, even providing funding for non-lethal techniques if one are available at the end of their season. And so we broached that subject with the Northeast Washington guys, and they're interested. They know it puts the onus on them, puts some work on them, but also when they're deciding what their neighbors are going to get paid for a depredation, it also puts them on point a little bit more along with the agency. But I do think that that's the kind of relationships that we need to develop in terms of trying to be successful at really helping them. It was interesting with
Commissioner Duvia.
Yeah, I'd like, maybe I can give you a little update on that, because they've been in my ear since we had the meeting. And Dave and Steve Brzezinger and I attended a lengthy cattlemen's meeting Wednesday night, and they actually were helping suggest that they come up with a board for determination and that. And so they've come back to me, and they would be really interested in structuring that and maybe sending a proposed board to the director to get his feedback and come up with that. Knowing that we, for whatever reason, there's a reluctance, as in Carlton, reluctance for people to contact us quickly, and or for whatever reasons, doesn't matter. But I think if we had somebody like this where they could call or knew that was where it was going, it will expedite our gathering of information so that we can be on top of these things better. Waiting 2 or 3 days to get a hold of us pretty puts us with one arm behind our back and trying to do the right thing. So I think for the communication, as well as probably a better balance and acceptance, that board is something we should encourage, and I think you got their cooperation.
Yeah.
Director Anderson.
Yeah. We introduced this idea at a meeting that I was at a month ago or so. And as Commissioner Duvia said, there was a lot of interest in doing that. I think we should think about what the composition of that board is that may take some of the onus off the individual livestock operators from being put in a difficult position, but at the same time being at the table. So we can think about how to do that, but I'm a very strong advocate of putting this type of group together so that they can have some ownership in the decisions that we make on these items.
So this is the third meeting that we've had with this group, and as in all new relationships, we're still building our relationship with them. Commissioner Duvia talked about the length of the meeting, and Typically, you always spend a little bit of time at the beginning of a meeting and building your relationship at listening to the problems, which we did again. But we did finally get onto the agenda about an hour and a half into the meeting. And I think we, and even after the meeting, I think, again, some of the discussions we had were probably the most valuable in terms of moving forward. And so I know a lot of folks tend to get frustrated, you know, when that discussion is pretty pointed and controversial. But one of the big things, and we do need to listen, and I think one of the big things that we heard from this meeting was that there's a lot of concern, and they again talked about regional delisting. But when we teased out the issue for them, it really is, when can they start lethal removal? And so that was the way that they were trying to help us get to lethal removal, was if they could do regional delisting. And so, as you all know, the plan does allow for lethal removal even at the state endangered listing stage. And I think that's the issue for them, is that, okay, it's there, but will you use it? And so I think they spent a lot of time, and they put a lot of asked a lot of questions about what criteria we would use. That's in the matrix that we've developed, the escalation matrix that I talked about. It talks about the plan laid out a fairly extensive list of things that the agency would consider, and then as additional actions occurred, when you would move towards lethal removal. As you'll also probably recall, our chief scientist, John Pierce, talked to you several months ago, before the plan was adopted, about some persistence modeling that we did in terms of looking at removals and how that might affect the recovery of the wolf population in Washington. And the bottom line is that once you have five packs, at least with the persistence modeling, once you have five packs, you can be fairly aggressive at lethal removal and not impact recovery. And so that's part of the message I think we need to get out and have folks understand, is that, you know, from a just from the science side or from the biology side of it, we can do that if we need to. And I think this group was saying it, and it wasn't based on depredation. So the other piece of what we heard from this group is that, why do we have to wait for depredations before, if we know we're being impacted, before we would consider something like lethal removal? And some pretty compelling information that they provided at the meeting. There was one fellow that was probably, at least in my mind, the most articulate and the best at explaining how his operation has been affected. And I already don't remember which pack he's associated with, but his operation is such that he purchases calves in the spring. He weighs them. Of course, he knows how many he just bought. He turns them out onto his range. He collects them in the fall, weighs them again, and of course counts them. He had 9 years worth of data before knowing that the pack was in the area, and he had average weight gains and average losses that he could look at, and his information showed that in the past, this last year, now that he's got a known pack, his weight gains were about half of what they had been previously, and yet last year was a good rain year, so a good forage year for cattle. And yet his weight gains were about half of what they had been in the past, and his calf losses, I already forgot exactly the percentages, but they had increased significantly to the point where he, at least above average losses, were about 8 calves. And so when you add up the financial cost of that, based on the weight gain and the cost per pound of beef these days, and the loss of those additional 8 calves, he estimated his losses at about $46,000. And just as Commissioner Duda talked about, when they look at that and try to make a determination of, is it effective to use a range rider where you might, which right now we're finding costs about $20,000 a summer. So when you look at using a range rider, how many calves might that save, and all those kinds of things, that's the financial decisions that these folks are making. And so it is pretty important for us to get a better understanding of some of that. And so that was his one of the points that came up again, just to reiterate, was that they're already seeing some differences in their cattle operations associated with having wolves, known wolf packs in the area. And so can't that be enough information for the department to trigger at least to take a look at lethal removal potentially in those situations? And so I think our commitment is to work with them to try to figure out how we can best document, because a lot of the operators didn't have that level of information, but how we can best document those impacts and then make those kinds of determinations on whether, you know, what kind of management activities we might use in those areas. So in the interim, we've got, as I mentioned, with the one landowner in the Wedge area, we provided him with fladry and then issued him a Caught in the Act permit if wolves penetrated that fladry. In addition, we've just finished a contract with another operator, and we're providing a range rider for him. It's about a $20,000 contract. Half of it's covered by Conservation Northwest and half by the agency. And so we'll see how that works. We've offered that to the Thurlows in the Carlton area as well. At this point, they're not interested, but we're also looking at some other techniques that we might employ just off of their property instead of having to go on their property. So those are all going to be really important for us to sort through in terms of trying to ensure recovery.
Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly supported lethal removal when we adopted the plan. I'm sort of, and thank you, Commissioner Keeney, for bringing up the point about the Thurlows. And because to me, I think we have, how am I going to say this? I think lethal take, caught in the act permits, is a great tool, but I don't expect to be the first tool pulled out of the toolbox. As an example, and I'm not meaning to pick on the Thurlows, and they are in a special situation since they're on the western two-thirds of the state, but if they have additional interactions and they're not taking any steps to minimize those interactions, then to escalating it directly to lethal take, even though we can't do that in this situation, but in a different part of the state, seems a little extreme. It's like I'm expecting us to be working with the cattlemen to figure out how we do that, and lethal take is a tool, but not the tool that we should be referring to. And again, especially if we're talking about a Caught in the Act permit, the ability to actually probably use that and realistically is pretty low. So besides the Caught in the Act permit, you know, what are we talking about for a lethal take? Is that where you guys would go out and specifically trap them on site? How would you know the individuals you're taking are the ones that were associated with the depredation?
There is a whole decision tree, if you will, associated with when it's time to remove an animal or a pack. Dr. Myrtle just got back from a Western States workshop, a wolf working group, that talked about the timing of that, and we're learning a lot more about wolf management because of all of the efforts of the Rocky Mountain DPS states, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. And one of the things they're finding is that you can actually be more aggressive and not, again, impact recovery. And so Dr. Murderwell is going to write up his notes from that meeting and at least share that with the agency staff. But it still requires, you know, a thoughtful process in terms of going through everything that you might consider and have tried and then determine the relative effectiveness of those things. But I think the agency is strongly committed to making sure that we do as much as we can to avoid lethal removal. But if it makes sense, then I think we need to be prepared to do that as well.
That makes total sense to me. I just, you know, as long as we're doing due diligence before we end up there,
right.
That makes sense. But as long as I've got the mic. So we did issue the one Caught in the Act permit up in the Wedge. Did that ever get used? Is that been in a timed situation? Is that expired?
I think it was for 30 days, do you remember, Director? And so it's expired now, but also that he's those calves are no longer confined, or that calving operation is no longer confined that way.
Great, thank you.
Let's give Dave a chance to finish. How's that?
Questions?
See, it didn't take long.
I agree with what Commissioner Jennings says, but just to make sure that understanding the Roy Graber's cows who we issued the permit to, and also did the flag array around his place, was a little bit unique because he had brought his cows in for the winter, did not put them out on his winter range where he normally was. He kept them in a small half-acre corral, but we had he had visible sightings, and we had confirmations and cameras that there was a pack of wolves circling his little corral he had there. Every 3 weeks they'd show up, and so eventually and he initiated the flag array himself, and then the staff came up and expanded that, so we had a little more room to operate it. And we did have the wolves enter into the area, but it appears that they probably got shocked by the hot wire we had around, and it brought their attention that they maybe shouldn't be there, so they circled and went back out. Most of the cattlemen there, that's not how it works. They put their cows out, and then they move them to a wintering spot in Umatilla or somewhere, and then they bring them back and put them back out. And when they put them out, they put them into a 3,000, 5,000 acres, it might be 30 miles square. A flag array is impossible. And when they went to the meetings on the range riders and stuff, and Jay's told you about those, and talked with Jeff Dawson, who's the one that's going to be our first, and John, they're going to use a range rider. And we now have a caller on those things. They're really excited about that, and we're going to work with them with where we know they are with calling and sequence. So the key that they feel is we'll try range riders, and $22,000 is a good investment, and this year it's not out of their pocket, so everybody's looking forward to it. But the two key things that makes that successful in their eyes is that, one, you have a collared pack, because you can position yourself when you get up in the morning, and it's a half a day ride to where the cows are. You can't randomly go out and find that spot. Secondly, the ones that they talked to did have permits. They did shoot wolves. They did harass them by shooting at them or taking wolves, and that's probably the two biggest positive things that range rider affecting us is knowing where the wolves are, so you can get in between and or given doing some significant hazing if they do show up. So personally, I think we ought to really look at our definition of issuing a permit if they go to the expense of the range rider, and we have confirmation. We don't have confirmation. We've got suspectly that the Dawson's lost 7 head last year, above and beyond what they normally do. We haven't found a carcass yet. We can't say what happened to them. But if we could look at that and say we probably have a problem with half of them or a third of them or 90% of them, and then we give them a permit to the range rider, knowing what full well that it's probably little to slim chance of having a lethal removal, but it would probably make that program twice as successful. And so I think that's something that we have to look at and say, okay, is our plan currently giving the tools to protect an industry? And as Dave mentioned, Pete Guglielmino, he paid $46,000 last year for the recovery program. Most of the cattlemen are either have weight loss or physical loss. So the cattlemen in Northeast Washington are paying tens of thousands of dollars for wolf recovery. And they're saying, well, we can't do this very long. And if this continues, we're out of business. And it's probably next year or the year after they're out of business. So there's a sense of urgency for us to come up with the tools to give them protection. They're not asking for removal of wolves or not to recover them. They're saying, we want it. We're being robbed. You know, every day somebody's taking our money, and we want to protect our business. And we're handcuffed with what we can do, but I think we just got to ensure that we're working our hardest to protect, to me, what isn't a fair thing. They should be tried to be keep them as whole as we can as we go through this recovery process and we learn how to manage wolves. But right now we got one group of people that are funding the wolf plan at big time.
Madam Chair, just wanted to follow up.
Okay. With
Commissioner Jennings. So following up on the range rider topic, what sort of tools do are the range riders allowed to utilize? I mean, what's from a harassment perspective? Are they allowed to shoot near the animal but not at the animal? Do they use pyrotechnics? Do they just have to use their physical presence?
In the case of the eastern third of the state, all of those would be available to the range rider to use. And we're preferring to use pyrotechnics rather than, and it's called a scream around that we will provide them with, rather than actually shooting above or at the animals, or around the animals. But yes, those are all available. And my understanding, at least, is that the other thing that a range rider provides is just the human presence, and that seems to be fairly effective at keeping wolves away. But also, if they know of wolf presence, they can get go in and move the animals, the livestock, away, and or just be present and vigilant in terms of scaring the wolves away.
So I've heard concerns that range riders are very effective for the first, 8 to 10 weeks, and then the wolves are watching the process and saying, I understand the pattern now, and so if I wait half an hour, then it's a different scenario. And so that's where I think sort of how do we keep that tool active. But
you bet.
It sounds like you're ahead of me on that thinking.
Well, at least the people interested in wolves are ahead of us. But anyway, I think the other piece of that is that we've got some materials coming called rag boxes. And so within this is a radioactive guard device. And what that does is that when an animal with a radio collar on it comes within a designated distance of that rag box, it's got depending on how it's developed, it can have up to 12 different noises that it might emit at different times. And again, it's just one more thing that you would employ at different times to keep the wolves away.
Okay, we've got a lot of hands up. Go to Commissioner Carpenter next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to thank Commissioner Jennings for asking my question for me about the range rider. I have a comment as it relates to the sensitivity of the timing of lethal removal. I agree with both commissioners that spoke. But I think we have to be sensitive to the position of independent business people, which is what these cattlemen are. And in these economic times, I don't care what business you choose to be in, whether it's selling cars or being a cattle rancher. Chances are these independent business people have to have a bank that's agreeable to work with them. And these banks are beyond conservative when it comes to loaning money and funding any type of a business through the slow time. And you have to have a gold-plated financial statement on an annual basis if you're going to get funding to go out and buy calves. And I just think we have to be really timely to react, because having these folks go out of business is not the right thing to do either. So,
Commissioner Perry's been waiting patiently.
Not very patiently. I don't know where I want to start here. We've been talking a lot about depredation and so forth, and I don't think that's the point. What galls ranchers more than anything is not the loss of the animals, but the inability to protect their property. just a basic ability to protect their property. I think that a more liberal distribution of Caught in the Act permits would be a huge move in the right direction. It's largely symbolic. Research work that's been done in Idaho shows that they are not effective. They do not result in wolf kills, rarely result in wolf kills. But at least it gives the person some confidence that if a situation occurs, they're not going to be branded as criminals. And I think that we need to focus more on the people than we do the wolves. Also, dealing with the ranchers, I truly agree with Commissioner Duvier. They are paying the bill, and it's often fairly large amounts. Ranching is not a very profitable business. They hang on from year to year, and they get a good year, they sort of catch up, and then it's hang on for another few years. It's a lifestyle. It's not a profitable business. That said, the Department of Fish and Wildlife needs ranchers to maintain the level of fish and wildlife in Washington to satisfy the recreational demands that that are out there. We can't do it just on department ground. We have to have the private lands and other agency lands, and the ranch lands are often naturally vegetated areas that provide a lot of habitat for wildlife. I think we need to take that into consideration and give them significant leeway because of their contribution, both from a habitat standpoint and from a financial standpoint. Most ranchers that I talk to don't want to get rid of all the wolves, but let's keep them at a point where we are having adequate big game species and the ability for the ranchers to get along with them. That's all they want. And right now that isn't happening. We certainly don't want to get into a situation like Idaho where the thing is simply out of control. It was reported by Nate Pamplin's counterpart in Oregon, in Idaho, at an Oregon meeting I went to recently, that they have killed about 300 wolves plus or minus with their hunting and trapping season this past months. And yet their spring counts indicate that their population has increased by 15%. We don't want to get into that situation. We want to manage them as a sustainable level, but maintain the rest of our resources out there too. I don't think that's a bad way to go. We manage all the rest of our wildlife like that. I think we ought to manage wolves like that as well. I also think we should focus our efforts. We have limited efforts, and I want to compliment you for starting a wolf management program. I think you've done a good job. I think you're moving as fast as you can, and you're really putting a lot of effort into it. And Commissioner Keening's comments about what happened I think are really good. You know, they are really trying. But on the other hand, our wolf plan is focused on numbers of breeding pairs or packs out there. We really can't do anything until those numbers are documented. And I appreciate your comments about having two collars in each pack, but it seems also important to locate as many packs as possible so we can get to a management point under the dictates of the plan we have now. And by focusing where we've already collared wolves doesn't really get us there as much as I would like to. I'm expressing my own opinions, but I think these are often expressed by the public as well. It's a little bit frustrating to the public to have announcements come out that the papers picked up, and maybe the newspapers were distorting them and so forth, but the way it came out, the way I read it at least in the Spokane paper, was this is the first documented kill, and even this one wasn't documented, it was only probable, where the people that are out there in the countryside with livestock and that are looking at this situation know that there's been all kinds of other kills. This just makes us look like we don't know anything, the department. And it just galls me that happens, because we do know what's going on. We are giving it our best effort, but that doesn't show it. It doesn't show it at all. And I'd like to see it come out in a little bit different way, and that puts a better light on the department, because I know they're really trying to do the right thing. I'll stop there for now.
Okay. Commissioner Caney is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a great discussion, and I agree a lot with what my fellow commissioners are saying, and really appreciate Commissioner Duvia's, you know, giving that right on the ground input. And I think I would have loved to have attended the workshop that Commissioner Perry got to go to, and I also attended a workshop in Colville that I wish more could have attended. We're going to be needing to gather information. We're going to be needing to gather experiences from other areas like Idaho, Oregon, Montana. The workshop I attended had a little more positive look at it, and they were using range riders, and it's not a magic tool, it's just a tool. They learned in their topography and their landscapes and their range areas what seems to work the best for them using range riders. But it was encouraging that in doing that, groups of ranchers, for instance, in Alberta, came together and started to realize the range rider tool could be shared amongst them. And I think this livestock operating team, you know, might get there at some point to say, well, this is something we got to take on and look at as a group, as a community of ranchers. And they had fairly good success in that effort, but it took time and it took staff and it took them realizing they had to hire people. And that's not always going to be able to be funded through the department or whatever. And so they looked at it as a business decision and made a business decision and decided to put people on staff to do that work. And it was very critical that they had communication with NGOs, with the departments of wildlife, to make sure the wolves were collared, to make sure they knew where they were, to make sure how many wolves they actually had, which was, you know, a lot of that was done through volunteer community efforts. So it not only gave the ranchers a sense of hope, it gave the people that want to see wolves return as well a sense of hope, that there is a way this can happen. But it also has to be dosed with a big, heavy dose of reality, that no matter what we do in this situation with wolves returning to our state, there will be animals that die, livestock that die, and there will be wolves that need to die. And I just can't say that enough, that this reality has to be clear, you know, and that the public needs to understand that as well as ranchers and those people most affected, hunters and those that are going to be most affected. In another area in Montana, in the Blackfoot Challenge, again, they're not perfect, but I think that the numbers, if I can remember right, I'll have to look them up. Somewhere in about the last 5 or 6 years, they've had about 10 or 12 livestock loss in a huge watershed with over 8 packs in the area, and they've had to take out about 10 or 12 wolves. But they are doing it based on some very good information, you know, that's very surgical in a way, and trying to make it work and keep those losses down to the landowners. I think when the wolf plan was originally passed, the concept of paying for compensation was a good one. I don't think at that time maybe everyone believed that the loss of weight that livestock operators were saying could occur or had already been occurring was necessarily believed. I think it's time to believe that. And I think the numbers that you said, Dave, you know, people still can't get their heads around that they would lose that much weight, that they would be stressed that much out in the field, that the livestock by wolves just being present. And so it's up to all of us to learn about how wolves' behavior and livestock behavior truly does occur. And that can occur, listening to the speakers I listened to. This is going to be about changes in human behavior to adapt to wolf behavior that affects animal behavior, so livestock behavior. So it's a lot of changes that have to occur if we're going to get through this with the least amount of damage, I guess, on the business side of things with ranchers and on the life, or excuse me, the wildlife side of things with wolf recovery. $46,000 loss. How many people, you know, really sit here and think about that? Could any one of us in our own lives or business take that? You know, that's a very compelling number that, you know, even as a wolf person that I would like to see them return into our system, you're going to have to look at that at some point and say, did we have it right when we talked about when lethal take could occur, when that tool could be used, you know, just after just for compensation on a depredation? You know, there's going to have to be some thought put into that, I guess. And these livestock cooperatives or the teams that are forming, I think, are going to be critical to that. You know, but then the public demands, I guess, that is not just done without careful thought. And so the science that is being brought to us by the department that says, you know, just taking out wolves sometimes doesn't solve the problem. Well, okay, how do we marry that then? We know there's going to have to be some taken out. We know that we don't want to do it in a way that causes dispersal of animals that have learned to predate on livestock, and they take that to other packs, because that can occur too. And I'd really just encourage this commission and everyone to think about other places that have learned what works. It won't all apply in our parts of the world. It may apply in other areas better than others. Northeast Washington, I think, is a classic example, and Commissioner Duvia said it very well, that they turn out into huge pastures that groups of 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 animals are over, you know, 4, 5, 6,000 acres. The range rider pilot in Northeast Washington, and I want to remind that's what it is. There'll probably be animals lost. We're hoping there'll be less than last year. We're hoping there'll be better or less weight loss, but it's going to be a learning experience, you know. And I think we're going to come out of that effort knowing maybe what can be done better the next year. I think understanding that range riders, for instance, in that big of a territory, will probably only be able to get to a particular group of animals about once every 3 days, you know. That's just the reality of the landscape up there. So it's going to be hard work. Having those wolf collars is huge, and I'm really glad they got the right collar on. I think that's very important, so that range rider will know daily and can, like Commissioner Duvia said, plan their activity. And, you know, whatever type of hazing we can allow, I think, is going to be important as well. So thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Smith?
Just a few short words. Congratulations. This is not easy. There's truth in what everybody says, which makes everything much more difficult. But I see the dedication that's out there and doing the due diligence that's necessary. Jay mentioned a couple things that I just heard the word Alberta mentioned, you know. But in BC and Alberta, I mean, we talk about Idaho and Montana all the time, but north of the 49, you know, that have been living with this issue for a long time, and the state of their cattle industry, I don't know how, but I think there's lessons to be learned. But sure. I think a lot of times that 49th is a wall on both sides of it. But the issue of poaching and illegal harvest, illegal killing, taking is something that we don't, that doesn't surface, but it's one of those hidden secrets. We all know that's going on, and we all know it will continue to go on and accelerate as emotions flare. So putting that into the equation as best we can, I think it has to be on the table when we talk about this. There's truth in all this, but well done, Dave. I mean, you guys are doing what you can.
Commissioner Jennings was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when we were debating the wolf plan and ended up passing it, you know, I certainly learned more about the weight loss and stress costs associated with livestock and try to address that. And I'm not sure we really have appropriately addressed that in our current compensation package for that. So I know you guys are looking at it. I just want to say I think that's a good move. My main reason for asking for the this time is to sort of caution the commissioners when we're talking about this. Let's not be too simplistic in how we say it. Commissioner Perry said we can't do anything until we have the right number of packs. And in fact, we worked very hard to give ourselves all the tools we need, all the tools we knew that were available, other than public hunting at our current stage. So I mean, when we get the current number of packs, it's going to let us potentially put, you know, let hunters go out and help us. But the whole rest of the tool set is available now. So to have for us to talk about we can't do anything until we get all the packs in place, I think it's really doing a disservice to us and the message we're trying to put out there to everybody else about we are working very hard to use adaptive management and figure out how to deal with the wolves coming on, how do we minimize impacts to ungulates and cattle operations and recover wolves. But I don't want the message to be that we're hamstrung until you know, we get 15 breeding pairs documented, because that's not the case. We have done our best as a commission to provide a full suite of tools now, excluding what we're not legally allowed to do until we get them recovered. So,
Commissioner Perry, who's next?
Yeah, I can't argue with that. The tools are out there. We've defined them. But as usual, the devil is in the details, and the ability to use those tools are dramatically restricted by the decision tree that was mentioned, the documentation that often isn't out there, and so forth. The tools are there, but the ability to use them in a efficient manner really, really is not. And this range rider concept probably is the only non-lethal tool that really has any possibility of working over the long term. And I guess this conference I went to in Oregon, they pointed out that wolves are observational learners, and they test situations. They watch situations. They look for opportunities. And that the non-lethal methods work for a short time until they figure them out, and then they don't work very well after that. Same with the range rider, unless they have the ability to concentrate on the wolves. And Dave mentioned it earlier, and I was really glad to hear that the radio collared information would be given to the range rider so they could focus their effort on trying to steer wolves away from livestock concentrations and so forth. I think that's a really good deal. It seems in other states where they've used range riders, the ability to at least shoot at wolves, if not shoot and kill them, is an important tool that they have. And Alberta and British Columbia were mentioned, and I think range riders are very effective up there, but they're able to actually kill wolves, so their presence is much appears to be recognized by wolves. There isn't much scientific documentation of that, but it appears that they become a lot more afraid of people and their presence out there. Therefore, the range rider's ability to steer them away from livestock is a whole lot better. I guess I'm not saying we don't have any tools to use, but I would like to see, in terms of adaptive management, maybe a little more liberal use of those tools, or the liberal ability to use those tools and what we've laid out. Again, giving the landowner something to work with, I just can't emphasize that enough. Livestock operations, particularly range-based livestock operations, people don't often see their animals except every few days, maybe if they're out there when they move them between pastures and so forth, which is good livestock husbandry. Range rider probably won't see them any more often, and the wolves will figure that out. I just worry that we're not going to be able to do enough without limiting the wolf population to a sustainable level, and therefore minimize the overall problem. The way the tools are used, I just don't think we're going to be able to do it effectively without a little more liberal use of those. Again, I'll stop.
Okay, Director Anderson.
Thank you. Great discussion. I'm glad you're having it. I'm glad I'm able to listen to it. I hope, and you've, some of the comments that have been made, I think, but I appreciate your recognition of how much effort we're putting into implementing the plan. I think the of all the things that I've heard, the one that is maybe been the most striking to me is when the livestock operators express the relationship they have with the animals that they have under their watch, and their frustration and their inability to protect them. And I think that's what Commissioner Duvia expressed here a little bit ago too. And it really hits home. So thinking about how we can put them in a position where they can protect their livestock that they have a relationship with, that I think is difficult for some of us to understand, is an important concern to address. One of and I was wanted to ask Dave a question about the range rider is, and that is, who is that individual, whose employee is that? Is that the livestock operator's employee, or is it our employee, or is it anybody's? Is the individual anybody's employee?
Independent contractor, certainly we're the ones that developed the contract with the individual, and so okay. They would be reporting.
I got to be careful here, though. I don't want to go down a road in a conversation here too far. But if that's the case, do we have the ability, obviously, in the area east of 97, to allow that individual to lethally remove an animal that's caught in the act of attacking livestock?
Yes, east of 97.
And we don't have to issue a caught in the act permit to that range rider. We could make that part of the provisions of the contract because we have a contractual arrangement with that individual.
I'd have to look at it. I'd have to look at the details of how we might do that. Okay. But we could potentially make the contract a permit as well.
So that's something, based on this conversation, that I want to explore, and that I'm going to explore to see whether or not I want to make sure what we're doing is consistent with the plan, and if it isn't consistent with the plan, making sure that if we're going to do it, that we've had the right communications, like we did with the caught in the act permit that we issued a month or so ago. But I think that would be, to me, an addition to the range rider and program that might also help have raised to the level of acceptability and willingness to employ the use of a range rider as a means to deter and protect livestock. So I was trying to think of how to make that happen, and I think the relationship that the department has with the individual, that is that individual under that scenario is acting as our agent, gives us the ability to do that without going through this issuance of a Cottonee Act permit that is envisioned and planned to be given to someone that's independent of the agency. So I'll stop there, but I just wanted to share in my conversations with the livestock operators, the conversation that we've had here, this trying to provide the ability for that livestock operator to protect his property, I think is critical. The range rider program, I think, and we'll see, I think offers some ability for the livestock operator to do that. And at the same time, we want to make sure that we give the range rider the appropriate tools, the full suite of tools that we can, to make him or her the most effective they can be in carrying out their duties.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and couldn't agree with you more, Director Anderson. And I think what the director just went through highlights what we had a discussion in the Wildlife Committee is it's our plan, and we started it off to say we will live, learn, and adapt as we go. So the plan is handcuffing our staff and our director to make this program successful. The director had to go out in extraordinary efforts to ensure that he was issuing the first protection permit that we sent out because it violated our plan. Not the essence of our plan, the intent of our plan, but our writing of the plan. And as we talked in the wildlife community, we need to come up with another stage of how do we confirm deprivation on cattle. And so I think that's something the commission has to take a look at. Maybe the wildlife community can come back with suggestions and discussion at our next meeting, and we amend our plan so that it would enable the director to be more efficient in his time and effort to issue range riders or permit. It would also, and the tools that you mentioned were handcuffed there too, because if we don't, we have all these cows down on the ground, but we have no, they're not confirmed because of the plan. So all the tools cannot be used. Only a few tools can be used. So we're not enabling us to do the things we want to do and we intended to do because the plan doesn't allow it to be done. So we got to come up with another way to have confirmation of cattle kill, that type of thing. So I think that's our job, and that's something we have to come up with, and hopefully we need to do that in our July or August meeting because it appears we have enough wolf activity in Northeast Washington, we're full. And so we're going to end up with some more problems for our staff when all of a sudden we have the cows are on the ground. And so, okay, now what do we do? Do we leafly remove them? Do we relocate them? And how do we confirm it? Because as Chuck saw from his survey and what we saw up there, it's less than a 5% chance that you'll find a carcass. You definitely won't find a carcass within a time where you can confirm it. That first picture you showed of the wolves that we have on a camera, you got visibility of about 20 feet, 25 yards maybe. That's where it's going to take place. And it's going to take place at dark at night, most probably. If they can find the birds flying, they might be able to locate it sometime the next day. Too late to determine, other than the wolves were there. So I think there's some serious things we got to look at as commissioners to make the plan so that the staff can do what they're trying to do.
Commissioner Kaney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And back to Director Anderson's proposal, I think that sounds really good, and especially if it brings confidence to the process of range riding in the livestock owners' minds, I think that's good. I don't believe it will get used very much, but it's okay because it gives you additional tool to those people that are out there on the ground. I would say that of the little bit of training and trainings that I've attended, one of the most successful areas where range riders are used, and I'm not saying it will work out this way in Northeast Washington because the landscape might be different, but where they use the range rider process to retrain livestock, particularly cattle, to behave differently. And as the person that came and talked from Alberta said, if a calf or a yearling runs to a wolf test, they will die, regardless whether there's a range rider in the vicinity or not. And that will typically happen at night. So you really have very little control over what goes on at night other than to hopefully in this process change behavior of livestock, which is what some of the most successful range rider programs are doing, is actually getting the livestock, where possible, to behave more in a herd mentality and stay together and learn not to run. And that's going on in different places, and I think it's maybe some of the most exciting things that we could bring to our area. Where wolves are going to expand into the South Cascades and there's more open topography, it might be one of the most important tools we have in the end. I'm not saying in Northeast Washington where it's hard to keep 5 or 6 or 10 animals together, it will work the most effectively. The other thing was when I heard some of these speakers that came from Montana and Alberta, one of the most impressive speakers was a rancher that actually is doing most of the range riding for the organization now. And his talk, and we went out for dinner with a couple of ranchers from the Colville area and this particular rancher as well as their director of their program, I asked him, I said, why? You're in Alberta. You can shoot any wolf you want. You can just take them out. I said, why aren't you just doing that? And he said, well, there's two reasons. We found they just come back. You have to think about that for a little bit. And then he said, also, the public wouldn't allow it. They didn't want it. And we realized we were better to figure out other ways to do this than just kill wolves. He says, we still have times where we kill wolves. But the two factors that hit them were they were going to sell more beef if they pleased the public. And the second one was if we kill as many wolves as we kill, they'll come back. And this isn't an area where they can kill as many as they want. So I thought about that quite a while and said, well, are your efforts, though, successful in some of these other techniques you're using? And they said, yes, we're having good success in keeping wolf predation down on our livestock, but it takes a lot of work. So that's the change in human behavior that could take a lot longer, I think, to realize. Because, you know, you got to remember, it's been, 80 to 100 years of we've always done it a certain way in terms of livestock, in terms of ungulate populations even. So, you know, this is going to take some time. But I would be very, it's very encouraging if you can hear from places that they've made a certain part of this work. And I would encourage all of us to keep looking for that in workshops, in learning, and you know, help the situation. So,
thank you. Commissioner Perry?
Yeah, I like the comments that Commissioner Keeney just expressed, and I also want to encourage the director and Dave to follow through on those ideas that were expressed. I think they're really good ones. I like the local board concept also. That gives a more local ownership of some of the decisions that are made. And I think that might work out really well depending on how that board was put together. I also think that, and Dave said this earlier, but I do want to emphasize this, that wolves are really adaptable, but ranchers are really adaptable also. And they're going to find a way to make it work if they're really serious about their business. And I've worked with a lot of ranchers over the last 10 years, and they're amazing folks in terms of how to organize their operation so it actually works and they can provide enough forage and good natural resources on their places and so forth. They'll find a way to make it work. And I think the department needs to keep a good relationship with the ranchers to find out what that stuff is. May not necessarily come out. But I think under this local board concept, that might be a way to consolidate this information, get it out to other people. But again, I want to emphasize also that the actual loss of calves is less important than the impact that wolves have on livestock production in general. And every single rancher I've talked to has expressed that the loss of calves, yeah, that's something. It would be nice to be compensated for that, but it's the lower conception rate, the lower gain, the fact that it's much more difficult to get the animals to use the available forage out there because of how they react in an area where the wolves are present. And through this board concept, and you mentioned that earlier, Dave, and I really like that you were looking at that and maybe how to work that into the program, and I think that's really positive. That's more long term, but I think it will be a something that the ranchers will really recognize as positive. But if that board concept could be looked into more, I think that would be a really good idea.
Okay. Someone else? Well, I let this conversation go on because it was so important to have. We talked about the importance of being adaptable as a commission, as a department, and I think everybody understands the intense interest there is in the subject. So the fact that we just spent about an hour and a half, almost, or maybe more, 2 hours, is not at all a bad thing. And I wanted also to express my gratitude to staff for the work that you're doing. We know that this is extremely difficult. I mean, we're kind of in the middle of it. We hear from our constituents a lot, but you're really in the middle of it. And it's requiring long hours, lots of frustration and anger is being expressed to you directly. So I want you to convey to staff our appreciation for the hard work that you're doing. We understand especially that it's difficult in light of all the budget cuts, the reductions in staffing. You're carrying a tremendous workload. So we appreciate that. Okay. We will continue to pledge to follow this very closely. So we'll see you again the next meeting.
Okay.
To talk some more. I kind of call this wolf therapy. So because I think that exchange of information and give us lots so that we understand what's going on and what thinking is, I think that's beneficial for all sides. Okay. I think we're going to run out of time before we get to committee reports, other than that we do need to vote on that vacancy for the ADA committee. But let's go on then to take a break. We have a break scheduled, so let's take 10 minutes.